Accession number 22086, Reel 4.
Colonel Shakespeare, Reel 4.
You've described the attack on the monastery at Cassino, and that you had a lot of casualties, couldn't get into the abbey itself. What was the immediate aftermath of that failed attack?
Well, we had to sort of regroup on the start line, really. The attack went in at 4:30. In half an hour or less, we realised that we hadn't made a yard of ground with our counter. B Company commander, General Ramsay Brown, we got us back and we didn't dig in. We stopped on the start line in case the opposition came at us for a change. And I can't remember now the details, about 9 o'clock or the second in command came forward to take over the battalion. The CO was wounded. I think whether I told you or not, I'd been walking along a little track and a Spandau fired and the bullets missed me by a whisker. And when the CO went, I said, "Don't go up there, there's a fixed line on it." He took no notice and came back with a stomach full of lead. And we had to get our casualties back. And I think it was the 2nd, 7th Gurkhas, they worked as porters, took our casualties back, brought a bit of ammunition forward, and we stayed the whole of that day and were withdrawn that night.
Did the enemy make any attempt to follow up the...
No.
Repulse.
No, they stayed firm. Well, I'll give you a case in point. The D Company commander had been hit, and I think there was certainly one officer went to get him back. He was hit, and then I think there were three or four Gurkhas went to get them back, but they were all hit, and the para boys took no notice of the Red Cross or anything like that, and so they were left. D Company commander found killed later on. The B Company young officer who went out was blinded and taken by the Germans later and looked after in prison camp. But we stayed put and withdrew back to where we started from.
That was near Monte Carlo, wasn't it?
No, not far. By Brigade Headquarters.
Brigade Headquarters. Mm. Looking forward from that forward position in daylight, could you see much of the German positions?
No, nothing at all. There was sort of bits of scrub and stuff around, and you couldn't really see anything that I can recall. The mediums came down, and they unfortunately fired straight on top of us and very nearly killed the acting CO, but he got his orderly, cut him in two. And that sort of thing went on. DF fire and machine guns from behind us, the MMGs fired to keep the enemy heads down. But nothing really happened. We hadn't, our battalion communications had gone. Our wireless set had been there. So we threw the gun on that. We heard roughly what the form was, and we were told that we'd pull back that night.
You mentioned that the casualties were evacuated. How was that done? Were they carried back on stretchers?
Yes, or walking wounded, a few stretchers. I can't remember it. All I can recall is later on when I went back, well after we had moved on and Rome had been taken, I was sent to take some photographs. And I was going down to our front line on a track and said to the Gurkhas with me, I said single file because mines were all over the place, ours, German, you name it. And my ex-orderly was a bit of a card and he was 5 yards to the right and blew his leg off. We had to take him out. And could we find a stretcher? We couldn't, of course. It was long after the battle, but all the stretchers around were just smashed to pieces. So, in our time, I suppose, they must have brought some stretchers forward.
When you went back, were you relieved in place before you withdrew?
No. We stayed there. We were virtually the sort of reserve battalion, what was left of us. I mean, it was half a battalion, in fact. And the Royal Sussex and the 416th Punjab were up in the front line. And we were back by the, what they call the Large Bow, Brigade Headquarters area. And whether it was the next day or the day after, we were sent up to Snake's Head. And we took over behind the Royal Sussex on Snake's Head. We had two companies forward and one back. We were down to only about three companies anyway.
Did the casualties and the failure of the attack have any noticeable effect on the mood of the soldiers?
No. We were damned angry, I think. Because it was the first time we'd really bitten the dust. Our last big attack was Wadi Akrit, which was a very successful night attack in North Africa. And this was the exact opposite.
When you went forward again, behind the Royal Sussex, did you get involved in any further attempts to push down through the monastery?
No, we just held the line. And listened into what was going on, virtually, the New Zealanders in Casino, and as I say, we held the line until the 15th of March, when the monastery was again bombed. As the 15th of February was the first bombing, and 15th of March was the second heavy bombing, and we were there holding the line. There was one, I can't remember the dates now offhand, but the Brigade Recce Squadron did a tank attack up a track, and I've again forgotten the name of that track, built secretly, and the Germans didn't know about it, up behind the monastery to Albanetti and in. And I did mobile power controller to the mortars, and I had anti-tank regiments, 4.2 mortars, and three battalion 3-inch mortars, that's 18, that's 36 mortars under my wing, and brought all their fire onto Albanetti House, while the honey tanks, they were the light tanks, went forward to try and get in behind the monastery. And the Germans thought that a big attack was going in with infantry and everything, and in fact a company of the Royal Sussex was there, and there was so much shelling and mortaring and stuff going on, nothing happened at all. The leading tank brewed up on a mine, and that stopped everything. They had to withdraw.
Was it only a one tank front, practically?
Yeah, literally.
What were your orders for supporting that attack? What were you supposed to be doing with your massed mortars?
Oh, just paving the way, giving as well Albanetti House, keeping the heads down so that the tanks could nip through. And then very nearly did. The Germans just put one anti-tank mine or a couple or something, just in case. And I'm told again, I don't know, that they sent a signal for reinforcements. They thought the big attack was coming in, and so down came the reinforcements, and taken on by the Army Group Royal Artillery, Agra, took them on, and I think it inflicted quite a number of casualties on the Germans in that case. But our attack fizzled out.
When you went forward as the mobile fire controller for the mortars, who went with you? Was it you on your own? Or
I can't remember. Myself and probably a Gurkha with a radio set. I didn't have any gunners or anyone.
Did you go with the tanks?
No. I was on Snake's Head.
Yes.
Watching them coming below me and across.
So you could see from the Snake's Head.
Yeah, I could see.
Ridge.
Not terribly well, but I could see Albanetti House.
So you could correct the fire of the mortars on. You could correct the fire.
Oh yes. Yeah, they were quite.
How far away was Albanetti House from?
From where I was, and 500-600 yards, I suppose. Yes, the mortars, for the fire was quite effective. No Germans hopping around. Kept them inside, anyway.
Did they attempt any sort of counter-mortar retaliation?
Could well have been. But if they were counter-mortar, I wouldn't know. They didn't come on me.
No, they'd have gone on the mortar position.
On the mortar position. But there again, now, I can't really recall where our mortars were set up, probably in the large bell somewhere, Brigade Headquarters area.
So they'd be shielded from
out of
sight?
I think so. They were well out of sight of Monte Carlo, which was the one that overlooked everything. Yeah.
And your positions on the Snake's Head Ridge when you were holding the line, what sort of positions were they?
Literally, it was a sort of a thin red line, really. Snake's Head Ridge was sort of shaped like that, and for artillery, defensive fire, it was very, very tricky, because if you brought it too close, you hit your own troops. If you lifted it too much, then it finished 400 or 500 yards the other side. So it was not what I call DFSOS. Really, you know, within 100 yards of your position, that was impossible. The configuration of the ground. And the gunners had to register twice a year, morning and evening.
Was there any possibility of bringing in air support?
No, not as far as I know, no. No, that was way above our heads.
You say you're in a line. Were you in? Were you able to construct sangars or any other sort of?
No, any sangars.
Sangars.
Yeah. A lot of casualties from sangars. Direct hits on sangars. Stones are just as lethal as metal, really.
What were the Germans using against the sangars? Were they using conventional artillery?
Oh yes, 105s, 210s. The 210s were their biggest. You could hear that coming. And Nebelwerfers. The Nebelwerfer, of course, just moaning mini, as we called it, was more of a frightening thing. One or two landed near me, but I wasn't hit. I don't think the explosive effect or the fragmentation effect of a Nebelwerfer was anything like a shell.
I think they originally developed to throw smoke, weren't they, as a weapon?
That I don't know. Mm. All I know is that they heralded their arrival. You could hear them moaning away.
Were you able to do any damage to the enemy from those defensive locations?
Not particularly. They didn't attack or anything like that. As I say, we were there in case they came. Funnily enough, you could turn round and backwards and you could see the monastery behind them.
Yes.
The monastery was 900 yards away from Snake's Head.
Yes. Did you get involved in any offensive patrolling or small-scale action?
Little patrols, recce patrols. We didn't, as far as I recall, we did not do much offensive patrolling because we were just holding. Normally, and later on, we did a lot of night patrolling, but there it didn't seem much point in it. They may have been, I mean, the Royal Sussex and the 416th Punjab, they may have little probing patrols, but the Germans were all in position and they wouldn't achieve anything, I don't think. We knew they were there.
Did you have good contact with the Punjabis and the Royal Sussex? Was your
Not as well as we should have done for the attack. Mm. I remember their company commander afterwards, I saw him the other day here under 4th Divisional lunch. He said to me, why didn't you, you know, we knew this, that and the other. But there wasn't time.
What about after the attack, though, when you were holding the line on the road?
Well, all I did once, I was one of their company commanders badly wounded, and I gave him a morphia jab. I was asked to do that. But we didn't sort of liaise with them particularly, no, because they were still down on the hostile, and we were up on Snake's Head, still divorced from each other.
Did the communications work? You mentioned when you were controlling the mortars, presumably you were able to...
Well, that worked fairly well. Mm. Yes, our 18 sets with the sort of company battalion headquarters, they seemed to work reasonably well there. I remember, when talking about this crest clearance, one night the gunner said, well, look, we've got to lay a new line. Because line was the best way of controlling things. I took a gunner officer and a sergeant, the reel, and I rang up Charlie Company commander. I said, I'm coming in on Snake's Head from the right flank. Warn your right-hand sentries, etc. And as I was creeping along, I don't know, 12 o'clock or something at night, I suddenly looked up and there was a Gurkha with a Tommy gun within 2 yards of me saying, halt. I said, that's the adjutant, sir. Oh, no. Adjutant, sir, what's your name? And I gave him my name. He said, what's the name of the CO? Eventually, we were all right. The gunner chap behind me, they were absolutely petrified. So he was a young corporal, lance corporal, I think, Dalbia Gully, who later, when I was commanding the battalion, years later, commanded my D company. Marvellous chap.
Evidently marvellous very, chap. Very keen on doing his duty thoroughly.
Oh, yeah, yes, yes.
Did you establish a sort of daily routine when you were holding the line? Did you live life to a pattern when you were on that... in the defence there?
Ah, I suppose you must have had a routine of some sort, but not a noticeable one. Now, up in the forward, I was adjutant, remember. I was back in battalion headquarters. I can't think of any particular routine.
I presume you'd have had stand to at some stage.
Oh, Lord, in the evenings and things. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Yes, we did all the normal. Hmm. And we had our sentries for battalion headquarters forward. And after the bombing on the 15th of March, parachute sergeant major came wandering in, and I happened to be out in little sentry. There were two sentries there. And one sentry saying to the other, he said, shall I shoot him now or wait till he's a bit nearer? And I said, no, we'll take him prisoner. They took him prisoner, and he's a great burly brute of a chap.
Was he deserting, or was he simply disorientated?
That I don't know. All I do know is that as we brought him into battalion headquarters, we were standing just outside, he and I, and the Germans started shelling the headquarters badly. And I was wondering, I said, when are you going to take cover? Because I won't take cover before you take cover. And he jumped into the trench, and I walked it. We sent him down to divisional head, to brigade headquarters, and on the way from there, he escaped.
He got back?
Yes. Yeah, he disappeared. Well, the mule line back to B.A. Schlong and all the rest of it was shelled every night. So they were sent him back one night, and shells dropped round, and people took cover. He just vanished. So where he went, no one knows to this day.
You said he was a big, burly chap.
Yes, he was. Yeah.
Did you get any more impression of him than that?
No. No, he was just a real tough nut.
Did you catch any other prisoners while you were there?
No, it was the only one that I got. No, we didn't have any others at all.
What was your battalion headquarters like? What did it consist of?
Well, it was Kesselring's Castle Mark II, the first one we had. I think I probably told you we went to, and it was in a 105 DF
yes,
task.
Yes.
And we moved very hurriedly the next day to the small crater. There were two craters, the large one where brigade headquarters was, and then up a bit, and then another smaller one. And inside there, the Germans had blasted another headquarters. So we took it over. And that was within sight of Monte Carlo, so we had a camouflage net, and we could look up at Monte Carlo, and they could look down and see us, of course. Every time you moved, you expected something to happen. Occasionally, almost an anti-tank, a 75 anti-tank, like that, and have a go. They certainly stropped up Cairo Village, which is the B. Echelon area. A vehicle going back, they had almost a minute gun firing on the track, but it was so regular you could wait till the gun fired and then you went off.
Did they leave anything useful behind in this?
Not that I know of, no. They had a very carefully shrouded it with a sort of sheet, I think, all the way around. And our little Sherpa cooker, called Corporal, or Furba was his name, he, with his primus stove, he caught this sheet of light one day, and the smoke issuing out of the hole in the ground was really terrible. And he said, well, my God, they must strop us, but they didn't. Really could.
Perhaps they thought you'd stropped yourselves.
Looking back on it, really, well, people frantically trying to put it out.
What did you actually have in these, in this blasted out headquarters? What equipment did you have in there?
A radio set. Mm. And that's how a couple of bunks. The CO had a bunk, and I had a bunk. Mm. I suppose the signals officer, there were only two or three of us there, and little Gurkhas, we scraped some holes outside. I did go back in 1980 to see how it was, and it was still there, but it had all fallen in.
What about maps? Did you have reasonable maps of the area?
Oh yes. There again, I can't. I'm not sure that we had, or the CO must have had a map. I can't remember seeing a map actually. We must have had a map. But it doesn't ring a bell with me. Not like later on and moving forward and things, one studying maps the whole time. Once we were there, and no amount of studying the map would have helped anything at all.
Did you get reinforcements coming up to replace your battle casualties while you were holding that line?
We must have done. We must have had one or two coming forward. There again, I suppose I should remember being adjutant, but I can't remember. I could have to go and look at the war diary and see, because I wrote the war diary every night. He must have had a few replacements, but not very many, I don't think. They came after we had withdrawn, came up from Benevento, the battle school or whatever it was, and joined us at Venafro.
Were you able to maintain the necessary supplies of food, water,
ammunition? Yes. The most important one was the rum ration. We had a battle with the doctors because we were some 20 foot below the level at which rum was authorised, and eventually we won it. And it didn't always come because the rum mule or pack mule probably may have met a shell on the way, and that was it, or fallen over the countryside. But the Gurkhas and ourselves, the officers, we much appreciated our tot of rum of an evening.
Did your clothing and footwear, was that adequate for the circumstances?
It was cold, yes.
Cold.
Going back again, we had things called gas capes. If you put that round you, as I did, a few sheets of newspaper, if you could ever find any newspaper, which is unlikely, it just kept us warm. It's battle dress. Boots, socks and things. We didn't change. In fact, it was a great, vast mistake to change anything. I went down and had a bath, Kaira village. After 21 days, thought it was high time, and it took 2.5 hours to go back up to the headquarters. By the time I reached it, I had a ghastly cold. I'd taken all the grease and stuff off, and I must say it's the quickest cold I've ever caught in my life, so there's no question of having another bath. And I'm quite certain, thinking back on it, or living out and fitness and things, that we were so fit, innately fit, not fit to run 100 yards or double 50 miles in 2 minutes or something, but basically fit, because one lived out the whole time.
You were hardened to
the hardened, course. Yes, hardened to exposure. Yes, I've often thought about that, you know. Like nowadays, the Test cricket team do all sorts of things, and they pull muscles and things. As soon as something happens, they can't play because they've overdone it. We didn't overdo it, but we were basically jolly fit. And when I was wounded later on, I'm quite certain that that had a good effect on surviving. It's as simple as that.
Presumably, just moving around at altitude would have a training effect, wouldn't it?
Yes. Oh, there was snow. It was snow. The worst winter they'd had for years, I gather. Again, it doesn't leave a great impression on me. It was damn cold. That was it. I mean, one accepted it.
How long did you have to stay up there on Snake's Head?
Oh, we were there, I think it was about 46 days we were from our attack on the 17th, 18th of February to about the 26th, 27th of March, I think, is when we pulled out.
That's a very prolonged period in the line.
Hmm?
That's a very long
period. Oh, it is. Very long, yes. As I say, we felt we weren't a TV. We had casualties about an average of 2 or 3 a day from just shell fire and what have you.
To have an endless trickle of
casualties. Oh, Lord, yes. Mm. The brigadier, a very tough ex-CO of a battalion, he used to go out and talk to the Royal Sussex every day at 10:30, and the Germans knew bloody well it was a brigadier, because he'd go with his gas cape and his garam topi, we called it, his caps comforter warm on, and with a little Gurkha about 10 yards behind him, going along Snake's Hedge. It was what do you call it, vineyard type draft. And as he went, Spandau, number second from the right on there, would open up and let rip every morning, have a go at him, but it was 900 yards, he never got him.
Did he visit you regularly as
he passed through us for on
so
the way.
So he'd come up to the forward positions every day? Did he do that in the morning or in the afternoon?
Morning, 10:30. He said he wasn't going to change.